Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, what authority do you have to be on this podcast?
I have all of the authority here. Thank you very much, Jackie Wheeler. Hi. I don't really know how am I meant to segue from that. We're obviously referencing the glorious video that was... I mean, it was publicly available, wasn't it? And then it was kind of propagated across Twitter.
Yeah. So the video is...
From Hanforth Parish Council.
Yeah, it's of a meeting from December last year. And I imagine quite a few audience have seen it, but it's a parish council meeting that just goes totally off the rails and is quite entertaining and does feature a very angry old man who happens to be chairman of Hanforth Parish Council asking this woman who's sort of like comparing the meeting, like what authority she has. It's so
joyous and really does kind of highlight why everyone should avoid local government like the plague.
I'm interested that's your takeaway from it.
The personalities it attracts are, it really is just the worst of humanity, isn't it? There's a few kind of like people who are really believe in the system and want to be there to kind of like uphold the system, but I also think that's a little bit nuts. And then the rest of them are all like just people there who want to get their conservatory approved.
Wasn't your dad a local councillor, Jazza?
Yeah, and I shouldn't tell you that. Yep.
How big is your conservatory?
The roof conversions was very nice.
I can't comment any further.
I've already said too much. So that's going to be the top. Hello, everyone. This is the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we meet bi-weekly to talk about politics, social issues and current events. The Hanforth Parish Council video, we are going to talk more about that. That's our final topic, because it's going to be nice topic. And fun. Jimmy is a previous writer on local government, so can Kevin give us the inside scoop?
Well, I don't know about that, but... I guess we'll see how that pans out. I've been meaning
you
to...
You can at least help us understand how much authority Jackie Weaver had there, though, can't you?
Well, I too have read the David Alan Green blog post explaining the extent of authority or lack thereof, but I won't spoil the audience anymore, although I suppose they could just go look it up right now.
No, don't you dare. Stay with us.
I've been meaning to say bi-weekly is twice a week. It's not, you know, once every 2 weeks.
Fortnightly.
Okay. Just to clarify, we haven't suddenly become very active in sending out podcasts. Anyway, Jazza, I feel like I've annoyed you now, but what's the, speaking of things that annoy you, what's the first thing we're going to be talking about?
You annoy me, Jimmy? Never. So the Europe, something that has annoyed me for the last fortnight has been the European Union nearly accidentally creating a border on the island of Ireland to stop vaccines being surreptitiously imported into the UK from the EU before the EU wanted them to be. And this was accidentally, apparently, proposed, because it never actually came into force, was accidentally proposed by Ursula von der Leyen and her team, without the consultation of the UK or Ireland, clearly two massive stakeholders in the creation, the de facto creation of a border on the island of Ireland, separating the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, which, I mean, has been spoken about extensively over the past like 4 years since the UK voted to leave the European Union, and it's slightly odd that they proposed that this was something that was proposed. They all walked it back, everything's fine and dandy now, but also we're going to use this as a chance to basically drag the European Union for being shitter at vaccines than the UK, because we love a bit of nationalism, don't we?
Yeah, I guess that is what we're going to do. So this is kind of in the wider context of the EU having a relatively slow vaccine procurement program and being behind the UK and also the US and also the United Arab Emirates. Maybe it's the thing about having United in your name.
Oh, you've forgotten Israel, which is not united.
Awkward. But it's I think this has been a rare bit of sort of a rare bit of good news for Brexiters, where the European Union has looked significantly less competent than the UK government. Which should be saved.
Yeah, we just had to have over 100,000 people die in order to get there, so that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, so I guess we're going to be discussing the implications therein and not at all relitigating the arguments of the past 5 years over our EU membership.
If you dare make it like that, I'm leaving right now.
And for our second topic, in a slightly weird, I think this is a weird topic for us. It's the whole GameStop debacle.
Is it?
Do you not think?
I feel like this is right up our alley. It's like the chaotic internet versus the establishment. Isn't that just an allegory for this podcast?
I see. And, you know, like the podcast, the shares of GameStop, after rising for several days, have fallen right back down to earth. So this is the story that a bunch of Reddit maverick investors decided to buy lots and lots of stock in GameStop, principally, but also a couple of other stocks that were low in value, and push the price up in order, I mean, literally in order to fuck with the hedge funds, basically.
Eat the rich.
Yeah.
Eat the rich, Jimmy. They're so yummy, especially around this time of year. Got all of that Christmas fat still on them.
Yeah. And this prompted the shutting down of one trading platform, Robinhood, temporarily, or it ceased the trading of shares in GameStop for a while. It prompted...
It ceased the buying
shares, okay,
in GameStop. Yeah, which is why it was like, oh, I wonder what you are possibly trying to do.
And it also caused various regulators to warn, to send warnings to retail investors that they could lose a lot of money, you know, after which some have done, so I guess that's fine.
What's been your take on the general thing? General positive or general bad, like retail investors kind of fucking shit up?
In some ways, it does show how ill-suited financial markets are to retail investors, by which is meant normal consumers like you or me, who could just go and buy some shares via Robinhood or another platform. Other platforms are available, versus the institutional investors, the hedge funds and that sort of thing, the professionals, if you like. And I guess we could have a wider conversation about whether that's good or bad, but I also think that a lot of people were conned into what was essentially a bubble, and I feel like a lot of normal people have lost money out of it. And it's one thing for professionals to lose money when they understand, should have a good understanding of what risks are entailed. I'm not really sure it's such a good thing when normal people end up losing, say, like a month's rent or something like that, or, perhaps even more.
Yeah.
So yeah, I suppose I'm one of the establishment stooges here, and hopefully you can play the role of the internet upstart.
Oh, excellent. I can't wait. Also, there was a report released by Paxful that was covered on the British Broadcasting Corporation. Paxful are a platform, a currency. What did they call it?
Cryptocurrency.
Platform. And they've released a report about the worries of... specifically, their report is about TikTok influencers who could be artificially inflating stocks themselves, and some of the moral quandaries around influencers and the ease of accessibility of financial markets. So that's going to be something nice and juicy for us to get our teeth into. Play some music. Beg for money. Why, yes, please.
Long-suffering fans of the Right to Honourable podcast will know that we have run a Patreon account for some time. This allows listeners to give us some money per episode, usually just a dollar or two, as it's in US currency. And that allows us to pay for things like hosting, occasionally microphones, just the standard gubbins that you need to keep a podcast online these days. One of the benefits that we've introduced recently are bonus segments. So every time we release an episode, we add an extra segment just for our patrons. You can access that by going to patreon.com/rightdishonorable. Another benefit is that during this part of the show, you will get your name read out, which some of you may not think is a benefit, but you know, different strokes for different folks. So without further ado, I would like to thank our existing patrons, Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, John O. Matt, and Michael Costa. Thank you very much for supporting the show. On a slightly cheeky note, I've just launched a Substack newsletter, just like any other journalist at the moment. You can access that by going to jdenichols.substack.com. Basically, I will be writing about things that interest me. So if you enjoy my random thoughts on the podcast, you might also enjoy things that are going on there. And I'll also be pointing to other bits and pieces that I've done, freelance journalism, stuff that's going on with the podcast. So kind of a behind the scenes thing, and also some free articles for you. So please sign up if you're interested. Jazza, as a rabid Ramona Europhile stooge of the European Union, and
love you too.
General Remainer, Ramona, whatever word we're going to use. This has been a bad couple of weeks for your people, hasn't it?
I mean, I feel like I'm dissociated enough from it to not really feel any kind of... I don't feel like Ursula von der Leyen necessarily represents my viewpoint on
and,
the world.
And that's the president of the EU Commission, right?
Yes, it yeah. is. Well done in asking that as if you didn't already know that. You made that sound very authentic.
I actually wasn't 100% sure. That was
she is the president of the Commission.
So she's kind of the head of the European government in a way. I suppose they have a lot of presidents in the EU, more presidents than Silicon Valley tech company.
Yeah, there were so many presidents. It is kind of ridiculous. But she basically has a lot of the authority when it comes to the general direction of policy. Mm. That then goes, she works in concert with the parliament and also works in concert with the European Council, which is basically just all of the heads of state of the, not necessarily head of state, but the heads of government of all of the EU 26 now? 27. Okay, cool, thanks. There's been a load of stuff in the last couple of weeks that generally she is that there's quite a lot of critique about her management style, especially the response to the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines.
Mm. I've actually got a quote here from Der Spiegel.
Oh, go on.
Which is a German weekly. It's
Der Spiegel.
Like, yeah, I think it's like the Spectator, New Statesman. I think it's right wing in Germany, mm-hmm. and they've described the vaccine debacle as potentially turning out to be the greatest disaster of her entire political career. So von der Leyen, as you may have gathered, is former German defense minister, I want to say, before she entered Brussels politics.
Yeah, she was summit German.
Yeah. The louder the criticism has grown, the less has been heard from her erstwhile loquacious commission president. God, this is actually written quite clunkily. Anyway, basically they're saying bad things. It's been a bad week for her in general, or bad couple of weeks, I guess, because the Article 16 thing, overriding the Northern Irish Protocol, is just part of this bigger story of the whole vaccine debacle, if you like. Do you feel that the EU got its vaccine procurement strategy wrong, or do you think it is still justified in having a unified strategy rather than letting individual member states go and procure vaccines on their own?
So I think that there is, like, it makes sense to procure as a group, right?
Economies of scale and that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's the reason that often the NHS gets really good deals on certain drugs, etc., and those kinds of things. And so being able to negotiate as a big group is actually, like, in theory, makes sense for the European Union to do that on kind of like a larger scale. The only thing that I think or that it looks like is more efficient is the decentralization of the distribution of those vaccines. But the problem seems to be that they didn't act quickly enough or procure enough off the bat of the vaccines needed for them to then distribute to the member states. Mm. Like, there are a number of vaccine centers that have been built in Germany, for example, that aren't currently sitting empty. And that seems like I think that the metaphor that von der Leyen used of comparing the UK vaccination process with the EU, and the UK being like a speedboat and the EU being like a hauler, like that, I think is probably quite a good metaphor actually for what is happening. But what they seemed, the differences that I am interpreting, we don't really know this because a lot of countries have not actually released how much money they have spent on vaccines or per vaccine, for various reasons. I think there are market reasons why they don't actually do that, but there are estimates. And what the UK seems to have done is just prioritised getting a butt ton of absolutely fucking everything, whatever the cost.
Yeah.
And the EU seems to have prioritised getting it for a good price.
Yes, that is also what I've read.
And so that seems to be probably the reason why it is ramping up much slower than places like, Israel, the UK, or even the United States. And I think that, hindsight is always 2021. Great.
Let's go.
Thank you. But it looks like in normal times, the procuring to make sure that you get the best deal for your members makes total sense, right? But that seems to have been a bad priority for Ursula to have in this particular case, because it has meant that they're a lot slower to be able to vaccinate the vulnerable people across the European Union, so that economies can then reopen.
I mean,
the Northern Ireland thing, I do want to say, objectively fucking stupid. Like, what was she thinking? And that seems to apparently be representative of a lot of her tendency, apparently, according to reporting from Politico, her tendency to centralise everything, and for a lot of her ministers, a lot of the other commission members to be kind of siloed and not really understand what everything is doing. Like the Irish representative on the commission, she was like, "What the fuck are you doing, dick?" I'm paraphrasing. I don't think she said that exactly.
I want to circle back to the Northern Irish thing in a second, but with the vaccine thing, from what I was reading, it's worth saying that actually, effectively, what the commission has done is it has prioritised saving money over saving lives, and as a result of the penny pinching, it means that more people will die, or people will die unnecessarily.
Yes. However, the European Union, I don't know, a lot of the comparisons have been with, say, Germany, who have lost about 60,000 people, right? Whereas the UK has lost just over 100,000. And a lot of the commentary seems to make those comparison, it seems to make, I think, the false comparison that you can either have loads of deaths and loads of vaccines like the UK, or fewer deaths and fewer vaccines. Like, obviously you can have fewer deaths and more vaccines, that obviously is the case, but that seems to be the false dichotomy that is being peddled at the minute.
Well, I think that with the UK approach to managing the pandemic, which neither of us have been particularly shy about criticising previously, the UK government has generally been useless and has generally not responded quickly enough. But the vaccine procurement appears to have been the one area where the exception that proves the rule.
Banging that drum as much as possible, right? Like, why did we approve the vaccine first? Because we're Britain and we're the best.
I mean, it seems to have been like I suppose it's interesting in some ways that the Americans and the British have been better with procuring vaccines, because it seems to reflect this kind of slightly more laissez-faire regulatory approach where you approve things first and ask questions later. I'm pretty sure I read that the British actually signed the procurement contracts a couple of months ahead of the European Union, which is why we're nearer the front of the queue, as it were, in terms of actually pharma companies fulfilling those orders, as it were. I think it's good, but it sort of mystifies me why we did this well and did other things so badly, because this is actually one weird example where the UK government was proactive and did things ahead of time and therefore got a good result out of it, seemingly. Whereas in all other cases, they have waited and dragged their feet and then acted at the, you know, just after the last possible moment where they should have acted, really.
Mm-hmm. Or like, it is fascinating. And I can't remember the name of the minister who's in charge of the vaccination procurement.
God, what is his name? I can picture.
Well, think that you think of his name,
just googling the background.
Like, there have just been so many cases of not only lack of willingness to act quickly on information and the likes of that, but also the inability to put the correct people in the position to run things like test and trace, to be able to, run the government. Hello, Pretty Patel. But like, there seems to have been like, for the party that prides itself on kind of like being competent with business and stuff, they've proven themselves to be incredibly incompetent at the actual management of things, which is maybe why Conservatives believe in privatizing everything.
Well, because they prove so useless in public administration that they assume somebody must be able to do it better.
Yeah, exactly. So, oh, I'm a bit shit at this. Maybe I should ask somebody else. Did you find the guy's name?
His name is Nadim Zahawi.
Nadim Zahawi. He seems to
pronunciation.
We tried. but he, I don't know. I'm just coming off of the back of an interview that he did with Andrew Marr. He seemed very, very competent and seemed to know what he was doing and why. Like, I reckon it's probably thanks to his management. Although it will, frankly, at the end of the day, it will be down to the civil servants who are working really bloody hard, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is the habit of the civil service to claim all the credit for when things go well and none of the blame for when things go badly.
Shush, 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 shush.
It's almost like they have their own interests to pursue in some way, but
Never are impartial. It's like the BBC, but for administration.
On the kind of Northern Irish protocol topic, it does seem to have taken the Irish and British governments by surprise. And actually, one thing that is interesting is that the Irish government has been more outspoken in its criticism of the EU government. Obviously, this is kind of all in the context of the EU representing itself as a stalwart defender of Irish interests throughout the whole Brexit negotiation period. Mm. This looks pretty bad, really, doesn't it? I mean, this is the sort of malpractice that you'd expect from British diplomacy in the last couple of years.
I will say, though. Okay, so I'm gonna parrot something that Stephen Bush said on in the New Statesman last week. Where I think the biggest fear for me is that the thing that the UK especially is going to think that everybody has learned from the accidental non-triggering of Article 16 was that we triggered Article 16 and look, it was absolutely fine. Because I think everybody assumed that Article 16 was put in place and that the most likely, place your bets now, most likely party to trigger it first would have been the United Kingdom. Nobody saw the EU doing this. I think that the EU is seen as generally a lot more stoic and sensible than the UK. And I think that this was more of a... This was bloody blunder rather than anything kind of, like, malicious. Mm. And the fact that it was accidental, I think, is shown by the fact that it never actually went into place. They went, oh, shit, and then rolled back everything.
So they were planning on triggering it, but they didn't? Is that...
Yeah, yeah, okay. That's what... that like, the, it never actually ended up being something that was enforced. And I worry that in the future, all of the crazy UK nutters are going to be like, oh, we can just trigger it because that's what the EU did and it's our right to and it will be fine, whereas actually none of the, like, it never actually happened, none of the consequences came to be, and I hope that, I mean, I hope that we remember that it was never actually triggered, and that does, it doesn't mean that triggering Article 16 is going to be totally fine, but inevitably it isn't going to be. So
I think it's more embarrassing for the European Union than the UK, not just because of the UK's generally slightly poorer diplomatic reputation, but
What, so because we've been so bad recently, because it wasn't us that fucked up, we've come out of it better. To be fair, that is probably true.
Well, there is that, but I think there's the wider point that, you know, Brexit was a nationalistic endeavour, and it didn't mm-hmm. pretend to be about anything other than national interest. But the European Union is supposed, you know, within its own values, is supposed to be better than that. It's supposed to be about defending international interests.
Well, and defending the interests of its member states, and Ireland is pretty fucked off.
Yeah, about, yeah. In a narrow sense, it is just about defending its member states. But it does have aspirations to be beyond even the interests of its member states. And I think this, you know, unfortunately shows that it is. I mean, this isn't a surprise, I think, to anyone who's critical of the EU. But it's not. It is an organisation, and you know, like the civil service, it has its own interests that it will mm-hmm. occasionally defend to the disbenefit of other people. So I was quite entertained by this story. But
what's your takeaway from it? Because I actually don't. I think this says more about Ursula von der Leyen, the way that she manages things, and her incompetency. To be completely honest, rather than anything about like. Whether or not it's a good job we left the EU, which I think a lot of particular commentators that you read, Jimmy, would probably...
I don't know what publication you're referring to.
Could possibly comment. But it, like, that seems to be like quite a facetious response that a lot of the Brexit media have gotten from this. And, well... I just told you, I think that's pretty facetious and stupid.
Yeah, well, I think that one important point is that if the UK was still part of the EU, we still could have pursued our own COVID vaccination procurement independent of the other member states. That said, I think if we were part of the EU, there would have been significant political pressure for us to collaborate with them on vaccine
procurement. Yeah, we almost definitely would have been part of it.
And right? As a result, yeah. We would, you know, we would have, probably, you know, things would have gone roughly the same as they have done. We would have had a slower vaccine rollout. Some people would have died, you know, because of that slower vaccine rollout. So I think that is a tangible problem to have been part of the vaccine procurement.
But fewer people would have died in the first place, because in this alternate reality, Jimmy, David Miliband is just starting his second term as Prime Minister.
Well, I think we're probably reaching the limits of alternative historical readings. You know, maybe Jeremy Corbyn would have been Prime Minister at this stage.
Oh, shut up. I didn't need that planted in my head. Thanks. My dreams are going to be terrible tonight.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, something to think about to lull you to sleep in the small hours. Shall we talk about GameStop now?
Yes. Did you get on the GameStop train as it rocketed up the, I don't know what to call it, graph? Like it went from like $3 a share to like $400-something a share.
These numbers go up. I do not dabble in the stock market on the basis that it's much easier to lose money than win it.
I have a stocks and shares ISA, but that does not lend itself to high frequency trading. That is necessary in order to be able to make money off of something like GameStop's stock being played. Sadly, no, I am not now a GameStop millionaire.
I think the thing is that there are people who will have got in early on the GameStop bubble, which is what it is, and they're, you know, people who were initially part. So you know, going back a little bit on Wall Street Bets, which is the Reddit sub forum where this all started, there were, you know, a group of people who wanted to push the price of the GameStop stocks up, and then other stocks of other companies up, in order to fuck with hedge funds that had bet that the value would go down. Basically,
specifically, it was Melvin Capital, which is, I guess
it's a hedge fund.
Yeah, it's a hedge fund that is, its founder is known for being kind of like, oh, really, like, he's really great. He plays risky bets and they always pay off. It's circle jerk. It's all of that.
Yeah, shit. I mean, his positions, not just in GameStop, have lost his investors. What is it? $6.5 billion.
Good, serves him bloody right. But basically, Reddit, off the back of the Q3 reportings, had seen that basically Melbourne Capital was really overexposed by shorting too much of GameStop stock. And then when opportunity, and then the all of Reddit and then the wider internet, first of all, was trying to figure out what the fuck is actually shorting a stock. I don't think anybody... I think that the best analogy that I had was kind of like you buy a Pokemon card and then you sell the Pokemon card, but then you have to sell it back. And
there are various ways of shorting a stock.
Oh, are you clever? No, please explain. Simply.
I'm not that clever, but I mean, obviously you can buy a stock and the value will go up or down and then you can sell it at a different price. But if you think that the price of a stock is going to go down, you're not going to want to buy that stock. So you're going to buy a financial instrument that will pay out money if you if the price of the stock goes down. So
What instrument is that? Viola? So, bassoon?
So the thing, when people talk about stock options, they're really talking about one of these financial instruments, and you have what are known as call and put options. I did look this up earlier, but I can't remember which one is which.
I have seen those words.
I mean, I think they appear in The Big Short, probably. But essentially, it's an option to buy or sell a stock. So you don't really own that stock. You just have that. You kind of have an option to, as I said, buy or sell the stock depending on where the price goes. So if you can agree that to buy the stock at a fixed price, then if the price goes, he says, trying to figure this out in real time, if you've got the option to buy a stock at a fixed price and the price of the stock goes up, but your fixed price is lower than that, it means you can then exercise that option, buy the stock at the lower price, and then immediately sell it on for the higher price and make money, for instance. So, but probably the easiest way, you know, it sort of doesn't really matter the actual mechanics of the different shorting, like ways of doing shorting. You know, there are different, you know, you're sort of getting into the weeds of finance at that point.
It's made up. It's all made up. A load of rich people with too much money made it up.
Well, I think this does actually kind of speak to a common criticism of, you know, this type of finance, is that it's not really obvious that it serves, you know, the real economy, by which I mean people who aren't just betting money, speculating on whether different stocks or different financial things are going to go up or down. So, like, it's a common criticism that actually speculators just at, you know, who are people that they don't own stock because they have a real interest in, like, whether a company's valuation is going to go up or down. They're not, like, investing for that reason. They're just, like, they're kind of gaming the system to make money, basically. And speculators will say, well, we're good for the economy because we're buying and selling stuff all the time, and therefore it makes the market more liquid, which means that, you know, if you're trying to sell a house is a relatively illiquid asset because it's difficult to sell. You can't just sell it quickly. But if you've got lots of speculators in a market, in theory, it means that whenever you want to buy or sell a stock, you have more opportunity to do that because there's speculators. Whereas if you didn't have those speculators, it would only be people with a real interest in those assets buying or selling the assets. So there'd be a smaller market, basically. So that's the argument. But I don't know. I personally are quite skeptical of that, because the other side of it is that people say that it adds volatility to the market. And one of the one of the ironies of this, like, all these people from Reddit coming and buying stocks, is it's made the price of the GameStop stock massively volatile. And generally when there's massive volatility...
Well, it's looked like a cryptocurrency graph, frankly.
Yeah, yeah, you can see it that way.
Which is the reason why nobody should invest in cryptocurrency right now.
I mean,
if I were your financial advisor, Jimmy, I'd say steer the fuck clear.
So the general advice that people give to retail investors, which is the kind of posh term for like a normal person just buying stocks or whatever, is to invest in an index fund, which would track the value of, say, you could invest in an index fund tracking the value of the FTSE, for example, which is the top 100 most valuable companies, public companies, I should say, in the UK, or listed on the London Stock Exchange, I think. I'm talking about things that I once used to know about and now can only vaguely recollect, so I apologise to anyone who does actually know about these things properly. But yeah, they say just do, like, an index fund is the most reliable way to actually gain value out of something like a stock market, because you're not just betting, you don't have to like pay attention to which stocks are going up or down. It just gradually tracks the progress of the market. And it produces quite reliable returns over time. But yeah, actually, this is the thing, actually, that, you know, some people have kind of described this whole GameStop thing as, you know, a populist rebellion against Wall Street. I can see why it's characterized that way. But at the end of the day, I don't think this has been good for retail investors, generally speaking. I mean, there will be some retail investors that have made money out of this.
Well, I feel like, yeah, exactly. I feel like there was a lot of a big frenzy whipped up, but then at the end of the day, a lot of those who were whipping up that frenzy were those who intended to sell it high and make an awful lot of money, actually, which is, I mean, capitalism, but also kind of reflects some of the problems that I think are being compounded by the fact that we have had this, I don't want to call it a great awakening because it sounds melodramatic, but I'm going to anyway. This kind of like realization of like of how trading works, how the stock market works, and now there are a lot more people who've read a couple of Wikipedia articles or watched The Big Short once or twice, and now think themselves, oh, you know what, I want a piece of that, and are now getting opened up to being targeted by financial influencers who maybe don't have your greatest your prosperity as their priority, shall we just say, and so this is kind of like talked about in the paper that was released by Paxful, where there are more and more influencers on TikTok who are posting videos like, buy these shares now and retire when you're 30, or these are the top three shares to buy in to get rich by the end of 2021. And there's a couple of problems there. One is the encouraging on short-term investment in the stock market, which, frankly, in my opinion, from what I understand about stock markets, nobody should be doing short-term investments on as an individual. You should leave that to the people with the powerful computers. Frankly, also has the possibility of those individuals maybe have shares or interests in the companies that they are encouraging people to buy in, and then they get to make a shit ton of money off of the millions of, or like at least tens of thousands of subscribers or followers that they have, who are then going to inflate the price of the stock and then make that person a lot of money. Which is true, right? Isn't that shit?
Yeah, I mean, I think that stuff is all pretty dubious, to be honest. And to be honest, if you're getting your advice, your investment advice from TikTok or Reddit, you shouldn't be investing. I think it's fair to say, you should.
There's the should there, but the fact is, people can.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing is that, I suppose my position is slightly contradictory in that I think that in principle you should be able to invest in stocks and shares on a public market without having to be working, you know, via a, you know, registered FCA regulated company. But at the same time, I think that most people who aren't registered to work as part of an FCA regulated company probably aren't, you know, shouldn't be investing, you know, just from the point of view they you've got to consider, like, you are competing against people whose job is to do this, and you're just some guy that's doing it on the side, presumably. You know, it's the odds are you are going to lose over time just because of the informational advantage that some of these places have, and the fact they're professionals and are practicing it every day, and they're working as, you know, they have an information network and all the rest of it. It's I just think it's kind of madness, to be honest with you. And, you know, the regulators in the UK and the US did warn about retail investors losing money. And then, you know, some people have lost decent amounts of money from this.
But the thing is, I mean, I'm not sure how useful this kind of stuff is. But similarly to whenever there's a betting advert in the UK, they have the bet responsibly. Don't, like, here's the hotline for anybody who's having betting problems. I mean, same with drinking and stuff like that. And with retail investors and any and even kind of like the established investment firms who want some of the rich people's money when you get off the DLR on at Canary Wharf. They also have the stocks and shares can go up or down, like there is risk in the market, etc., etc., etc. The problem is, part of me is like, how many people actually pay attention to that small piece of text or the words at the end of the radio ad? But also, all of that is, none of that is present when a micro influencer or an influencer influencer is talking about stocks and shares on TikTok, for example, or in any other social media site.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is kind of a wider problem that regulators in general have struggled to regulate the internet because it's so disaggregated. I guess you could regulate the social media networks and you know, come up with some rules to stop them allowing content like what you've just described, but I think I don't think financial regulators in general are the fastest moving bodies on the planet, particularly in the US and the UK. So yeah, it's probably something they should look at and deal with, but I don't think it's something they will do so speedily.
Before we move on, we've been kind of we've gone quite easy on the financial institutions that exist as they are up until this point. Like there was the fact that Robin Hood ceased all buying of Robin Hood stock, for example, on its of GameStop stock. And there is speculation that that was stopped, that was paused because they have ties to, I cannot remember the name of the organization. It's like Citadel, who were initial investors in Robin Hood, but also have invested in Melvin Capital, which is the main one that was being that was overexposed by the shorting of GameStop stock, and that just reeks of dodgy dealing. Also, the fact that, frankly, this is a free market, and they artificially created a bubble. But in a free market, Melvin Capital should have been hung out to dry and gone bust, frankly. but they found a load of all of this guy's mates. This guy who makes risky bets, but he's a proper lad. We love him. I believe that's and that's an exact quote from one of his mentors.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. He managed to stop going under by getting all of his mates to give him a load of billions of investment of a savings.
So a couple of other hedge funds injected some capital, as the jargon would have it, into Melvin.
And that, I mean, it just shows, like, if you know the right people, then you're fine, aren't you? It don't really matter.
Well, as the old saying goes, if you owe the bank £1,000, that's your problem. If you owe the bank £10 million, that's their problem.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so deep.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that if you have money, you can often tap up other people to get more money. Whereas if you don't have any money, and you lose it all, you're hung up to dry. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that any of the financial institutions in this game haven't acted in anything other than brutal self-interest. This will sound like I'm excusing the financial sector, but that is how it operates. It's not surprising that they would do that. I think when it comes to, like, again, when the way the financial sector is regulated, there's loads and loads of accusations that of regulatory capture, where, you know, the financial authorities listen too much to people in the sector, and therefore the rules tend to get distorted to benefit the sector rather than, you know, genuinely actually fulfilling other regulatory goals, such as, you know, reducing volatility or protecting retail investors and that sort of thing. Not that I'm accusing financial regulators of being completely negligent on that count. I just think it is something that is probably true. to a subtle degree. But so yeah, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, a lot of there was. I've got a friend who works for a hedge fund, and he kind of echoed the Financial Times' astoundment that Melvin were as exposed as they were to some of these in terms of some of these positions.
Well, high risk, high reward, right? But also high risk, you explode.
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe there's an alternate reality where you know, the chief exec of Melvin loses all the money, like, you know, is kicked out of the
yeah
funding.
But they don't exist. That's what happened after the financial crash of 2008, right? They were all bailed out. Like, no one went to jail, and nobody really lost any personal financial wealth apart from the people further down the chain who were affected by the bubble.
Yeah. I think that, you know, there are some institutional investors that have lost a lot of money on this trade, on these particular trades, and will lick their wounds and, you know, carry on. And then there are some people who, you know, bet money that they shouldn't have bet, and have lost it all. And I mean, that is bad, but I don't know what exactly are you suggesting that situation, we should
the
implement
only
rules
thing
to
I'm
stop
suggesting...
that happening ever again.
Jimmy, I've made it very clear. We should just eat the rich. I've said it multiple times. Please, please, please bear in mind that Jazza does not actually advocate eating the rich.
What sort of condiment do you think would go nicely with the rich?
I'm really into, like, barbecue, Korean barbecue sauce at the moment.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's proper tasty. Like, spicy, but also sweet and smoky.
That does sound good.
Jimmy, moving on to, I don't know why, but I keep on wanting to call Jackie Weaver Carol Baskin.
As in the, one of the slightly unhinged big cat owners from...
Yeah, who allegedly killed her husband and fed him to the big cats.
Yeah, allegedly.
I don't know, I just feel like she has a similar energy.
Is that libelous?
I feel like having saying that somebody has a similar energy to someone is beyond. I mean, I bloody hope it's beyond libelous. Jimmy, you used to write for a local government publication, correct?
I did, yes.
In which case, explain what the bloody hell happened in Hanforth.
So this was a meeting of Hanforth Parish Council. Parish councils exist below the what's thought of as the normal level of local government, which is like county councils and metropolitan borough councils and that sort of thing. I'm not actually, this is the sort of thing I should have looked up before we started recording, but they're
again,
the kind of...
Jimmy, don't expose us.
they're kind of like responsible for... overseeing the like immediate area. I mean, they don't even deal with like bin collection. That is actually over their heads.
It's basically planning permission. It is almost exclusively planning permission, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can actually, if you Google parish council, one of the first links is set up a town or parish council. So the fact that you can set up your own, I think, is suggestive of how many powers they have.
I fucking do one for East London. That'd be fun.
Yeah, I mean, there aren't actually any parish councils in London, I don't think. It's very like small fry stuff, basically. It sort of fits in with the stereotype people have of academics, that the disputes between academics are, you know, so brutal because there's so little at stake.
That what people say?
that's a phrase, I think. I've read it. It is a phrase now, spread that far and wide. Jackie Weaver was actually...
Icon. Britney fucking Spears.
We'll get to that in a bit. Is the chief officer of the Cheshire Association of Local Councils, which is roughly what it says on the tin. So she's not actually from...
No, hold on. Can you tell me what that actually means?
It is it's a body that kind of helps liaise between the various local councils in Cheshire. I mean, Hanforth isn't actually in Cheshire. It's kind of south of Manchester, I think.
Yeah.
But maybe it is in Cheshire.
Which is in Cheshire, Jimmy.
geography, not a strong suit. Maybe this
bloody
is why
bloody southerner.
This is why I don't write about local government anymore.
Outside of the M25, and he buckles.
Yeah, I mean north of the Thames is my limit. But yeah, anyway, this she basically was there to kind of I use the word compare, but that's not really the right word, is it? To kind of oversee the hand of parish council meetings, because there had been various kind of it was a very dysfunctional parish council. And there were kind of like arguments between members about kind of over legal questions and that sort of thing.
Well, basically, they kept on the chair kept on refusing to refusing to accept people's apologies for not being able to make meetings. And so was excluding certain members from the meetings, is what it sounds like from the previous council notes. And so two of the council members who had been previously who were previously unable to attend the meetings that were set up by the chair, then created this extraordinary meeting and asked a higher authority, well, not necessarily a higher authority, but an outside body in Britney Spears, a.k.a. Jackie Weaver. they asked her to oversee the meeting.
Yeah, so she'd sort of convened the meeting and invited everyone to the... I think it was a Microsoft Teams call rather than a Zoom call, judging by what somebody said during the conversation. But she was like running the meeting, and she had like, I mean, she had the authority, quote unquote, to kick people out of the meeting in the sense that she was the admin of the call.
She had the utilitarian right.
Yeah, she had like...
she was the only person who could kick people out of the call.
Yeah, yeah. So in like software terms, she had the authority. But it's... So basically the chair of the council and his vice chair as well backed him up in this.
Who are, can we just say this, the epitome of gammons? Aren't they? Aren't they though? Tell me I'm wrong.
Why do you think they're the epitome of gammons?
Because they're literal. I think the chairman, he's changed his the name as it appears on Teams to chairman something something, open brackets clerk. Which is not like he didn't have the role of a clerk in that meeting, but because he called himself it must be true. And they get so worked up and wound up that they're not getting their way that I'm pretty sure that the councilman goes pink in the face, which is basically what why gammons are called gammons.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. But anyway, the chair and the vice chair appeared on this meeting and immediately kind of started arguing with Jackie Weaver, kind of saying that she didn't have the authority to call this meeting, that the meeting was illegal, I think was the word used, mm-hmm. but illegitimate was certainly the accusation. And then they were both booted off the call. But there was this interesting, me and you both read this post by David Alan Green, who's a legal commentator.
Can we link this? Because it is so mundane, but so fucking interesting.
Yeah, yeah, we'll definitely put a link in the notes. But he basically says that, he makes the point, which I think is indisputable, really, that if the chair and the vice chair thought the meeting was illegal, then they didn't have to be there. Like, if the meeting is invalid, it's kind of irrelevant whether they're there or not, which, you know, I suppose that wasn't really the point. They wanted to, you know, protest the meeting by turning up to it. If you have two council members who want to call a meeting, which is extraordinary in a specific legal sense, they can do so. Seems to be the conclusion.
And so their accusation of it being an illegitimate meeting and targeting that at Jackie Weaver were false, because two other council members had called the meeting, which is allowed.
Yeah.
And Jackie Weaver actually had nothing to do with that. Now, the big question is, did she have the authority there to kick people out?
Well, this is
because it says in the standing orders, and I have read them and I have understood them, that only the chairman actually is able to kick people out of meetings. Obviously, this is written for times when people would have been there physically. But Jackie Weaver actually didn't have the authority to do that.
Yeah, that is David Alan Green's conclusion, that she probably didn't. But the chairman in this case, it doesn't necessarily mean the chairman of the council. It means the chairman of the meeting specifically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, well, does it? That's... It's capital C.
Oh, that was my... 'Cause...
Oh, my God. This is this is why lawyers love law, innit?
I thought it was the chairman of the meeting, because once the chair and the vice chair have been kicked out, Jackie Weaver immediately says, okay, we need to agree on
who the chair is.
And who the chair of this meeting is, rather than the chair
but
of the council.
But if the chairman is the capital C chairman of a committee...
I don't think the capital C... I mean, you know, legal documents fucking love their capitals. They spray them around like no man's business. I don't know if that is significant, the capital C bit. But this is essentially the discussion we're having now, admittedly in well-mannered tones, is the sort of argument that this council appears to have been having for months on end, just about like procedure and protocol, and not really anything about to do with the substantive issues of how like their immediate parish is run, basically.
But the reason I think why this is so bloody delicious is because of what you said before about the small fry stuff that parish councils deal with. Mm. And we get the minutes of the proposed agenda for the meeting that was meant to take place. And the agenda is... Sorry, listener, please bear with me. So after they are... this is the meeting that got that everybody has watched online. They need to receive apologies for absence, which weren't received last time. Talk about concerning legal stuff, blah, 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 blah. And then on the agenda is... review the new front porch for the house 722 house 7 Stretton Way, Handforth. Consider the single story front extension to the front porch of 17 Constantin Drive. To consider the proposed removal of existing garage roof and extension for Handforth Hall, Handforth Road, Perville. Like, it's literally, they're holding up, by having all of this Barney amongst one another, they're holding up, like, 7 or 8 people's extensions not being able to be made.
That is the real
And who,
the real tragedy
who
here.
Bloody cares? And if this doesn't turn into a fucking sitcom, then I don't know what will.
I read one article actually just talking about that kind of incivility of this meeting, which, as you say, is holding up umpteen extensions and other things.
But it's those the chair and the vice chair. They are clearly so self-important that they are holding all of this up. I don't know. That's how I read it, and that I think is why Jackie Wheeler has become such a memed icon. is because there's these people who are looking to be important in any way, shape, or form. And by being a council member of the parish council, that's how they are realising that. And they are being told, you're not doing the job properly, hun. And so they bloody lose it.
Yeah, I think that's true. But some people, one article I read speculated that the kind of general rancor in like American politics or like parliamentary politics in the UK has caused, you know, the parish council to behave similarly badly. But... You know,
nah.
Well, yeah. From what other things I've read, parish councils have always been prone to this kind of bickering. I guess you know, because to some degree, a parish council is just like a group of neighbours, and you know, everyone knows how neighbours can fall out over, like, you know, where a fence is built and shit like that. Like that is.
To be fair, my neighbour did try and take an inch of our property when I was about 12, and I remember that so vividly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of you know, disputes they kind of mediate over to some degree. I think parish, you know, local government is actually can be very petty and rancorous in that way. I wanted to just as we sort of like wrap this up, I'm wondering if you. If you think this actually says anything about like how we run our local councils, I mean, for one thing, do we really need elected bodies to actually preside over these sort of issues, or would some sort of, I don't know, citizens assembly type thing be better? You know, not having a permanent body, but just sort of bringing people in on a more ad hoc basis.
You answer that. You know it better than I do. Why wouldn't that work? Because I think parish councils are terrible.
Well,
in terms of efficiency and getting stuff done, and it's used by people become councillors. I can't speak for any of my relatives, but people become councillors so that they get stuff approved on their extension that they want to do. Like that, there's no honour in it, and who, like, what's the bloody point in it?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you watch that meeting, like, even when it's under control by Jackie Weaver and it is running relatively smoothly, I just think this, the whole, like, mode of address where everything has to be said in this clunky formal language,
it doesn't have to be. They think, this is so important.
Yeah, that's my point, is, like, yeah, there is a need for, like, bodies like this to solve local issues, but I don't think the elected representatives make a whole lot of sense in that context. I mean, when you get to the sort of like citywide level, I can see the point of having elected bodies there, because, you know, there's a lot more people. It's not really practical to have sort of small level conversations, I think. So, but I think there's got to be a question of scale here. And I'm a little bit scared. I mean, having seen this video in particular, I'm a little bit skeptical. But, you know, there's probably, I will say that in general, in local politics, there is actually more pragmatism and less partisanship than there is at the national level. And there is more actual, you know, we have a problem here that we need to deal with. And I'm not saying it's totally absent of posturing, because that would be false. But I definitely encountered more of a sense of, you know, cross-party agreement on how to deal with local issues than I think there is on the national level. But yeah, something that actually David Alan Green raised, which I thought was very interesting, is that virtual meetings in some ways are better for doing these sorts of things, because when you have everyone behind a screen, there's a certain equalizing effect, I think. I mean, particularly because, you know, there's no sense of physical intimidation that goes on, but also the whoever's clerking the meeting can actually just start muting people if they start behaving in an unruly way.
Oh, I wish they did that in fucking Parliament.
I mean, Prime Minister's questions would be a lot more muted, I think.
Oh, yeah. Just like as soon as Boris starts going off on one of his things about Starmer being unpatriotic, you just go boop.
Have you seen PMQs recently since then?
Yeah, a couple of them. I still prefer it.
You prefer it to the normal PM, like PMQs?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a bit more orderly, which I think is good, and there is less harumphing.
Ironically, with less, fewer people saying order. On that note. shall we fuck off?
Yeah, Jazza, where can they find you to tweet order at you?
Oh my god, please! Jazza John on all social media platforms.
You can find me at JDE Nichols on Twitter, and only Twitter, or you can email me, jimmy@rightdishonourable.com.
Great. Bye.
Bye bye.
See you bi-weekly.
Ha.